Bloody Elbow presents the MMA Vivisection, the show that gives you a comprehensive breakdown and expert analysis of all the fights happening on this weekend's UFC card. Here are your hosts, Zane Simon and Connor Rebush.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the MMA Vivisection with me, Zane Simon, and my co-host, as always, Connor Rebush. We are here once again talking about this week's UFC event going down in London, England at the O2 Arena. UFC making its first trip back to the UK since, been a while now. They were obviously supposed to go in 2020 at the first event canceled at the in the early stages of the COVID pandemic. And that was their first event in the UK.
Plandemic, Zane.
The plan, that's right. The scamdemic. I'm sorry. Thank you.
The scamdemic. That these are the two accepted terms as per the UFC press releases that, of course, we are beholden to follow.
Yeah. It's part of our press package for the.
Yeah. So at the start of the plan, the scam plandemic.
Yeah. They were supposed to go to the UK. The last time they actually went to the UK was in 2018. For Darren Till versus Wonder Boy. So, wow. Yeah. It has been a while. Wait, no, I got that wrong. They did Till versus Masvidal in the UK, and that was in 2019. So.
Okay. A little better. I mean, even though their boy got smashed, that's certainly a better memory of a more exciting fight.
Yeah.
How many of their boys you think might get smashed this time? That's such a common thread with UFC shows in other countries.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's true. Although, except Brazil. Feels like every time they go to Brazil, there's always like all the Brazilian fighters succeed.
Probably because like the most non-American fighters in the UFC are Brazil. So there's just more good ones.
Yeah, they're not. It's not like when they go to Singapore and they have to drudge up every random yoga instructor that they ever ran through a season of Tough to fill out a card.
Right.
But yeah, this is a pretty good card, honestly. It's a very well-tuned UK card.
Yeah, I quite like it. I'm a little confused by some aspects of the bout order. I got to be honest.
Sure, I can see that.
I'm not even going to... I mean, it's not an earnest question, but, you know, why is this the main event? I get it. Heavyweights, it's in the UK. They got to have the English guy in the main event.
It's also the closest any fight on this card is to title contention, to be frank.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah, I'm just sick of heavyweight main events.
Yeah, I get
it. Enough,
that.
Considering we've got another one next week. They're just not... You know, it's just not something that we had a light heavyweight one last week. How did that turn out? Put a real damper on the end of the card.
Yeah.
I'm just over that aspect. But the more genuinely perplexing thing is, why is Jack Shore, Timur Valiyev just in the middle of the prelims when that is like the best fight on the card?
That is a very good question. There's something. Maybe it's the UFC has like taken on the British dislike for the Welsh, because
that's what I was thinking.
Like I mean, Jack Shore was, you know, notable training partner of who was the other Welshman that the UFC just let walk away?
Jack Marshman, isn't he Welsh?
There's Jack Marshman, but no, the other bantamweight. Maybe they're not training partners. Maybe I'm just. He fights over for Bellator.
Brett Johns?
Yeah, Brett Johns. And it just felt like they were never interested. Like, Brett Johns was doing really quite well in the UFC.
Yeah, yeah.
And they just were not interested in him at all, it always felt like.
That's
and now
an interesting thought.
Jack Shore is now, like, doing quite well in the UFC. And he's just, like, plugged away down there.
They're kowtowing to the London fans by just sharing their anti-Celt bias.
Right.
That would make sense.
It would, wouldn't it? There's that. There's also, like, you know, Krylov, Paul Craig. That's a cool fight. Feels like that should be on the main card over Herbert Topuria, maybe even, or Carolina McCann, or, well, yeah. I mean, you know, it's one of those things.
It should be there over Carolina McCann, let's be real.
Yeah.
You know, who cares?
Yeah. There are a few questions with the bout order, but the real honest truth is they've done a good job for this card, just getting together a whole bunch of fighters from the area and getting them in really interesting fights that I want to see.
Yeah, and next week's card, another fight night, they're back on the upswing with, like, interesting undercards.
Yeah.
Last week was well booked. This week, next week, we've got interesting fights and fighters that I know who they are.
Yeah, that always helps.
Yeah, pretty great. So I'm not going to complain any further until something else crops up. Probably something you do.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm here. I am built to rankle you. God put me on earth just to make sure that you always are annoyed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Should we talk about this main event?
Yeah, let's talk about this main event. Heavyweight bout, Alexander Volkov, Tom Aspinall. And you know what? I like the fight, and I am not 100% confident in which way it's going to go.
No, me neither. It's an interesting booking. I do find it, I'm not surprised, but it is somewhat disappointing that literally in his last post-fight interview, Tom Aspinall explicitly said, I don't want to have a step up just yet. He may have, like, in my memory, it was so on the nose that he may as well have said, I hope they don't give me someone like Volkov next.
Mm-hmm.
And then they did.
I mean, it's his own fault, though. Like, you want to slow play your career at heavyweight. You got to lose more, because
that's true.
You can't win 4 straight fights in the heavyweight division and not immediately be in the top 10 of the division.
Especially not if you're a guy from a region of the world that the UFC is always like sees as marketable.
Yeah, it's just, that's his own fault. You know, I got no hard feelings for Tom Aspinall, but he really set himself up for failure on that one by succeeding.
Yeah, I mean, well, I would also like to see Tom Aspinall develop more. I think he's a really, really good fighter.
I think this is a good this will be, if it's not what he wants and he's not ready, I don't expect this to be an especially hard lesson for him.
No, that's true. It could be a very valuable one, even if he loses. There's such a, Volkov sits right at the top of that gap between good heavyweights and regular heavyweights, where, like, if he gets shunted back down, he's just going to have whatever kind of wins he wants to have for a while again, so it'll probably be fine.
Like
you said, it's a difficult one to figure out, because I think the only sustained fight we've seen from Aspinall was that fight with Andrei Arlovsky.
Yeah, and that was kind of a mess.
There were causes for concern, and there were also things to like. Which is why I really enjoy, come-ups like Jack Shores or like Bryce Mitchell's, like these fighters who get brought up gradually and have lots of pushback. You get to see how they deal with adversity and see the depth of their game. We had one example where we did see that from Aspinall, in a very heavyweight kind of context. He almost knocked Arlovsky out immediately, which is what he usually does. It didn't happen. He started to get tired. He started to become more defensive, which is an adjustment I like to see when someone gets tired. I've often praised my boy Hobocop Rodriguez for that.
Mm-hmm.
Except that he has heavyweight defense, so it amounted to like running straight backwards with his hands down and getting hit in the chin.
His retreating defense is really bad. Buster Keaton comedy kind of bad. Like, he really looks like he's doing an old-timey pratfall when he's...
Yeah, it's not good. He's clearly not comfortable when you put him on the back foot, and the fact that he, you know, these are things I would like to see develop, but I think he could improve.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, he did keep it together. He didn't gas horribly. Like, he was still in the fight. He didn't freak out when things started to turn against him. And then in round two, after a little rest, he came out and hit a takedown and finished on the ground. So, you know, it was a real learning experience where we saw some serious potential, I think, for the first time out of Aspinall, beyond just the kind of potential we usually see, like a la Chris Daukaus, which is running forward and punching someone.
Yeah.
So is that enough for me to be confident that he's prepared for five rounds with Volkov? Not really.
Not really. Yeah, it shouldn't be. I mean, that's the thing.
This is a huge step up in that it, not only is it a guy like Arlovsky who can extend you, who is more durable than Arlovsky, more capable of extending you, but a fighter who will proceed to slowly overwhelm you after that, which is something Arlovsky doesn't really do.
Yeah.
You either overwhelm him or you can't quite do it, and then he's still there in round three.
Mm-hmm.
Volkov is going to be doing damage and trying to pressure you and trying to make your life uncomfortable as long as you give him. And this is a 5-round main event.
Yeah.
So I don't know how it's going to play out, but I also don't know how I can't pick Volkov.
Yeah, I will say, and I don't really think you, like I say, I don't think you should pick against Volkov here, just because no matter how much you like what Aspinall has shown, Andrei Arlovsky is, and not a bad win, but
no.
Far and away his best win. Yeah. Like, it's otherwise Jake Collier, Alan Badeau, and Sergei Spivak.
Yeah.
And like, Sergei Spivak is very much a, are you good enough to be in the UFC level of gatekeeper?
Yeah.
You know? He's evolving from that level. Well, he started out as a guy who seemed like he clearly wasn't good enough to be in the UFC. The fact that Spivak is now like becoming a firm test of can you belong here at all, is a big, you know,
Aspinall didn't go out like Greg Hardy.
No,
he didn't. He didn't just get easily taken down and then completely discouraged and then not know what to do and then pretend he'd been knocked unconscious in order to save face. So that's something.
Yeah. No, Aspinall, like, beating Spivak is a very clear sign that Aspinall belongs in the UFC, but it's not a big sign of anything else.
No.
You know?
No.
That's kind of my point. The fact being,
Arlovsky is clearly his best win by a good margin.
Arlovsky is the cutoff for like top 15 to 20 in the division. And beyond that, what we can see from Aspinall in the cage is that he is really comfortable and confident on the front foot. He feints well. He pressures well. He throws almost every combination as a 1-2, whether it's an or 1-3 or whether he's putting an uppercut behind it or whatever, it's always stepping in with the jab and then following up with the right hand.
Mm-hmm.
But he's fast, he's accurate, and when you're confident and you pressure well and you're fast and you're accurate, that's a really good collection of skills for heavyweight.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Volkov is a dude that he's a lot harder to out-wrestle than his past losses way back in Bellator would have people remember.
Mm-hmm.
Really hard to just take down and keep down. And he is accepting Derek Lewis, almost impossible to knock out. And he's rangy in a way that a lot of heavyweights are not.
Yeah, Lewis and Minnikov, I think.
Yeah, and the Minnikov one is like he was not knocked out in that fight.
It's about as close to invulnerable as it gets at heavyweight.
Yeah, he is exactly the fighter you have to be if you're going to rely on volume and technique at the top of the heavyweight division, which means that you have to be absolutely unbreakable.
Mm-hmm.
And Volkov is pretty close to unbreakable. My only real concern for this fight is really that Gon fight, mm-hmm. where he just looked out of... Not only did he look profoundly uncomfortable with somebody capable of fighting as long as he did, or he does,
mm-hmm.
but he also looked like he was just not in shape for the fight.
Well, to add to that, I would say the Gon fight, and then immediately after, the Tabora fight.
Yeah, and that's what I was getting. Like, the Tabora fight was better for that, but it was not great.
Yeah.
He seems like, lately, he's getting tired really fast.
Yeah. Does seem like his fitness has diminished, or, like, he's just not as interested.
Yeah, maybe. But that is a concern, because for Volkov, like I say, he's not a power striker. For him, it's all about volume and consistency. Yeah. So if he's not going to be a cardio king out there, then he's just going to end up in wars where he absorbs damage. And maybe that'll be a lever for Aspinall. Maybe it'll be a close first round or two, and then he can use his youthful exuberance to pull away and
mm-hmm.
just outfight Volkov down the stretch. But we have to see it, because we have one fight that in recent history for Aspinall that has made it past the first round. The only other two fights he had that made it past the first round were losses, although one of them a DQ. And in that Arlovski fight, like, he got really tired in the first mm-hmm. round, and then had to pick himself up and recompose himself afterward. And he did that, but that doesn't give me a great deal of confidence that he is just going to have five rounds of cardio better than Volkov does.
Right, right.
So I'm not going to pick Volkov to get knocked out, because it so rarely happens. And at that point, I'm not going to pick him to lose a five-round decision. So, yeah, I got you. You have to take Volkov here, but this is a big chance for a shining moment for Aspinall, because Volkov isn't—he's not the biggest power threat in the world. He's not the most dangerous heavyweight out there, and he will, Aspinall will have a chance to work for five rounds. If he can find a way to capitalize on the potential that we've seen out of him, he gets a huge win. If he can't, then this is just going to be a learning moment about composure and cardio, which a lot of heavyweights have to have in their careers as they rise up the division.
Yeah.
More than, like, we talk about prospect submission losses and stuff like that. For heavyweights, it's really getting to a point in their career where they realize they actually have to be in shape and not just go out and swang and bang until they knock their opponent out.
Right.
So this could be that for Aspinall.
Yeah, it'd be cool to watch him climb up.
Yeah.
Volkov, I mean, what do you think is going on with Volkov? You think he's disinterested? He could just genuinely be past it too. I know, like, this division is full of, I mean, so many outliers are not even outliers, but, guys who have 8,000 fights on their records and just still keep doing it. The guy has been fighting for a very long time.
He's been fighting for 13 years. He's only 33, which means he started when he was 20.
But he's gotten hit in the head a lot.
Yeah.
And he's had, 43 fights?
This is what I would say, more than being the idea of him being past it. He might just be, because, I mean, heavyweight, I really do keep to the idea that he can easily fight until he's 40 and be a consistent top-level fighter. But one of the things I think we do see regularly with heavyweights is they tend to get, like, stuck in ruts.
Yeah.
And have to reinvent at certain points in their career to make mm-hmm. that happen. And that might be where he's at.
I wonder if, like, in part, like, dealing with his wrestling issues has made him just like enjoy the striking part of the fight less.
Could be. Yeah.
He had the fight with Curtis Blades and looked pretty good wrestling wise.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, I don't know, a couple fights after that, but now we've got, he had a lot of wrestling battles with Tibora that just, he did fine, but they seemed to make him miserable.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, it may just be that he's in that point, like, you know, the mid-career Arlovsky, mid-career Overeem phase.
Yeah.
Where they both just seemed, they looked defeated for a while. And then they just went out and changed a bunch of stuff up and then were fine for another handful of years.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not going to write him off because, like I say, this division, as long as you've got the chin still, heavyweight allows for all kinds of longevity and change-ups.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a concern. It is a concern that the last couple of fights have just been very listless from Volkov.
Mm-hmm. Listless and sloppy.
Yeah. He is a slight underdog out there for this fight, which is kind of wild to me. I opened at minus 146, currently up at plus 106. So a lot of money coming in on Aspinall. Maybe it's a home crowd money kind of thing.
I kind of get it. I mean,
yeah, I don't.
It's always hype. That's how people bet on things.
There's hype. And like I said, there's a lot of, you know, the UK has a gambling culture. So I would not be at all surprised if.
Oh, my God. If you ever watch like a BT Sports stream of Fight Card. It's always like some, you know, sort of rough and tumble East London type being like, bet on the fights.
Yeah.
You want to bet on the footy, mate? It's always, there's like eight of those guys. They all look exactly the same. They sound the same. And they all want you to bet on a slew of seemingly identical betting services.
Yep.
You can get your money on the high street. They talk about the high street a lot. What is a high street?
All right. Aspinall opened at plus 124. He's currently down to minus 128. That brings us to a featherweight bout. Arnold Allen, Dan Hooker. And this is a fight that I feel like there's a pretty obvious first read for this, and then I'm not at all sure that that read is correct.
We may have exactly the same feeling.
Yeah, because like you look at the run of success Arnold Allen has put together.
Mm-hmm.
You look at that fight against Sadiq Youssef, where he looked really composed and confident and fought really, you know, a decent fight.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look at Dan Hooker and some of the losses he's had lately and some of the problems and struggles in his game that have just never quite been closed up.
Mm.
You're like, oh, Arnold Allen should be able to solve this problem.
That's actually kind of the opposite of my initial read.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. My initial read was Arnold Allen never tries to come forward if the opponent doesn't want him to.
Yeah.
Even slightly.
Yeah.
And people tend to kick his legs to pieces.
Yeah.
He's a tri-star fighter. He's heavy on the front foot.
It's true. People
have lots of success with those moves, and he's literally never fought a guy with anything close to Dan Hooker's frame.
Yep.
So my initial read is, oh, he's going to let Dan Hooker pressure him and land kicks. And that seems like a bad idea.
Yeah. That is my secondary read, which is like Hooker really does not – Arnold Allen does not – represent a fight that looks like the kind of fights Hooker loses.
Yeah.
So, well,
yeah.
Yeah. Like one of the things notable about Allen's fight with Sadiq Youssef, alongside the pressure, and I've been saying this for a lot of years, and I know Allen has a boxing background, technically. I think his dad was like a sort of blue collar boxer.
Mm-hmm.
Is that there as a boxer in an MMA, Allen is very, he's very give take one to give one. Like he's not his boxing, you can see the skill of it. The notable thing with the use of fight is like his defense was very active.
Mm-hmm.
And even as he ate a lot of shots, he was always working to defend the shots that he ate usually.
Mm-hmm.
But he also just kind of ends up having to eat a lot of shots to make his own striking work.
Mm-hmm.
And when he hasn't, it has been because the pace has been so slow against somebody like Gilbert Melendez or Jordan Rinaldi that he can just kind of be out at a range that and working behind a jab where his opponent isn't offering a lot back at him.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Allen as a defensive, like his hands are in a good position, but I guess because he backs himself up and because he's always looking to counter.
I think it's because that's the problem with boxing and what is essentially a wrestling stance.
Yeah.
Your head is always in range.
Yeah. So he just always gets hit.
Yeah.
And that is a huge concern against Stan Hooker, who is going to pressure and who himself always gets hit and often gets hit because he has his hands in a position to defend shots rather than defend himself. But Hooker is a fighter who, if you give him a chance to build momentum, he usually finds a way to really start exploiting those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm not sure which way to pick on this, honestly.
Well, I'll tell you why I flip-flopped now.
Okay.
First of all, and I often overrate these things, so keep that in mind. But I have serious questions about Dan Hooker going back to featherweight after now six years at lightweight.
Yeah, I can absolutely agree with that.
Like, I know the guy has fought featherweight before.
Mm-hmm.
His body has changed over these years as a lightweight. He's a much bigger, more filled out fighter than he was. He was a very scrawny featherweight.
Yeah.
He doesn't look like that anymore. His shoulders, his chest, his back are all much thicker than they were. So I just think it has to be a harder weight cut.
Yeah. He was looking, I think he was at like 161, to start the week, which is a good range to be in for a cut.
Sure.
But that doesn't necessarily, you know, I'm not there. I don't know how the weight's going to fall off him for the next week.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, like, more and more these days, I keep expecting huge weight cuts to destroy people, and they just don't.
Yeah.
Like, it's sad as it is in some respect, weight cutting has gotten better across the board,
mm-hmm,
as a science or a pseudoscience anyway. And so fighters are cutting larger amounts of weight and having better performances and sticking around in those divisions. Jose Aldo is a prime example.
Mm-hmm.
He's a guy who struggled to make featherweight for many years. Now he seems to make bantamweight with very few difficulties and look great.
Yeah.
So, you know, probably overblown. I will say, even those fighters don't tend to look great in their first fight in the new division. They tend to have some hiccups.
This is true.
And in particular, Arnold Allen is a very quick fighter. And that is one of the major things that always stands out when you change weight classes is the difference in striking speed, like the relative speed. There are a lot of guys who suddenly look like power punchers when they move up in weight, because they are blitzing people that don't see their shots coming. And there are a lot of guys that go down in weight and suddenly are having 50-50 striking exchanges when before they used to be the quick technician. Sometimes this has happened to like Edson Barboza. So the problem here in particular is that Arnold Allen's very fast and Dan Hooker's very slow. He's already a slow fighter, even at lightweight.
Yeah.
He's not quick. And I had forgotten until just rewatching it that how close his fight with Nasrat Haqparast actually was early on.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, Dan Hooker had to eat a lot of shots, and Haqparast, just blitzing off the fence with the same 2-3, it hit him hard and clean, like, on mm-hmm. several occasions, because Hooker has bad defense.
Yeah.
As you said, like, his hands are lowered. He's thinking about clinching and getting underhooks.
Mm-hmm.
And he backs up in straight lines, and he doesn't have good head movement.
Yeah.
And the adjustment ultimately for him was to just sort of hunker down and just, like, walk forward through whatever shots Haqparast threw and grab clinches.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's going to be a little harder against Arnold Allen, because Arnold Allen is a much more consistent pocket puncher.
Yeah.
And just a much better adjuster. Like, Arnold Allen will, he can throw uppercuts.
It's true.
He's got a lot of variety in his combinations and his striking attacks. And that is, like, one of the good things about Arnold Allen, is we have numerous times seen him, like, start hot in a fight, things go awry, and then he figures out some, like, key maneuvers to get himself back into a winning position.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very scrappy, adaptive striker. So I kind of come around to thinking I favor Arnold Allen here, because in a fight that I would already expect to have just, like, a good start for Dan Hooker, and then a lot of opportunities for Allen to do something about that as it goes on, I now wonder how good his start is going to be.
Yeah.
Because I think he's going to get hit in the face a lot early.
Yeah, I mean, for Hooker, his fights are rarely about starting well.
Right.
They almost never, in fact, start that well.
Yeah.
It's always him engaging early, and it's starting out a war, and then some key part of his opponent's offense is breakable. And yeah. At that point, Hooker can just will his way through it to really start to break somebody apart and break them down and make them quit. But when they aren't, when that doesn't happen easily, then, you know, he often will just sort of never find his way towards a win. So,
yeah. Whereas Allen is rarely, like, blow you away impressive.
Yeah.
But is a very winning fighter.
He is a very winning fighter. The concern really with Allen is he's just not been a very dangerous fighter.
Yeah. I kind of suspect Allen might hit harder than it seems.
He might.
He's got super quick hands. I feel like he just doesn't often prioritize hitting hard.
Yeah.
But he sat down on a couple of really good shots in that Sadiq Yusuf fight.
He did.
That made me think maybe he just hasn't, like, been, like, lining people up and putting all of his weight into his punches that often before.
Mm-hmm. I remember still thinking to this day that he just really let Jordan Rinaldi have a much easier fight than he should have.
Yeah. Like, I sort of wonder if he's got a Drew Dober thing going on. Where he's
could,
like,
be.
He's, like, a really good athlete with big power, and he just doesn't fight like it yet.
Mm.
Remember how Drew Dober wasn't always a power puncher?
Yeah, no, he was very bouncy, light-footed, Muay Thai kind of idea that mm-hmm. it only came in a lot later that he started sitting down on stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. It could be. I'm just... Yeah, the length is just really concerning for me with Hooker, that he might be able to, like, mm-hmm. getting on the front foot and getting to be the longer fighter, that he can just make Allen pay for all the ground he gives early, and then maybe Allen finds a way back into the fight and keeps it tough, and it just stays close all the way through. Or, mm-hmm. you know, a big thing will be for Allen if he can hit takedowns.
Sure.
And turn that into offense. Will Hooker's size actually insulate him from that at 145? Because that's got to be what Hooker is hoping.
Yeah. I honestly don't know what Hooker's hoping. I feel like
yeah.
Didn't see a lot at 155 that made me think you need to go to 145. It's done for you here.
Yeah, I don't think it makes much sense to me, frankly. I mean, it's not like it's not like Islam Makhachev, you know, wouldn't do that or doesn't do what he did to Dan Hooker to just about anybody else.
Yeah, exactly.
That is going to give up. If you're going to give up even one takedown to Islam Makhachev, you're going to put yourself in the position to be submitted like that.
Yeah.
And
should everyone Islam beat move down to featherweight?
Yeah. And otherwise, like, you went strike for strike for a solid part of that Dustin Poirier fight. Like, what else do you want, you know?
Right. I agree.
Yeah. I don't know. Part of me just still feels like Allen is just sort of... I don't want to say, like, you know, he's not getting lucky or something, and he's not underperforming or anything, but he's just kind of getting just the right fights that don't feel like it just still feels like there's a big problem in his game that is not, you know, that he's just not become a dangerous enough fighter, and he's not pulling ahead of people when it seems like he should be able to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like even that Yusuf fight, like, it feels like Allen should have been able. Alex Caceres had a cleaner boxing performance against Sadiq Yusuf than Arnold Allen. He got hurt more because he's a worse athlete. But
yeah, he was more... I don't know about that. I don't know if I agree with that.
No? Let me see if I'm just talking out my ass here.
I mean, we can look at stats, but I feel like Caceres had a few moments of genuine success in that fight. It was largely just us realizing that Yusuf looked really flat in these sorts of awkward, frustrating matchups.
Yeah, I mean, I would still just argue that Caceres was able to consistently land more punches and be a better boxer inside, navigating when Yusuf tried to initiate punching exchanges.
Mm-hmm.
Caceres was really a lot better at slipping those punches and countering in general and not getting hit in return. He got his legs kicked to pieces for it. It was, you know, Allen won their fight, Caceres didn't, and it was for very clear reasons.
Yeah.
But when Yusuf stepped inside with Allen, it felt a lot more like Yusuf gets
always a, yeah, it's always a scrap rather than like a slick outmaneuvering.
Yeah, or when it's a slick outmaneuvering from Allen, it feels like almost nothing is really happening. Like he's just kind of fencing somebody off.
Yeah. Well, the guy's got no head movement.
Yeah.
Head's in range. He's got to move his feet to get out of range. And at that point, everything's out of range. That's the problem with that stance. I've been saying this literally as long as I've been doing this.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I'm going to pick Hooker just off the glimmer of idea that he's going to be harder to out wrestle at this division. And he will be long enough that he can keep punches in Allen's face at the distance where Allen would normally just try to be totally away from his opponent to outslick them and from way outside.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to pick Hooker.
Yeah, I'm kind of expecting that to like turn this into a scrap by necessity, to be honest. Because as much as Allen will have these sort of close fights where, yeah, he can get like picked apart he doesn't often get picked apart, but where he can be sort of either shut out of a fight or dragged into a messy one.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're looking at getting dragged into a messy one being the more likely outcome here.
Yeah.
And there I have serious concerns about how Hooker deals with somebody with just super quick hands who can actually adjust and throw combinations in the pocket when, you know, guys like Hockpress, like it wouldn't be the first guy who's had success countering Hooker off the back foot.
Yeah, No, it can happen. And like I said, Alan, he's always trying to make the right defensive moves. He's always keeping his hands in place to defend and trying to shell up and make, you know, keep himself from getting hit when he has these exchanges. And Hooker does not. That is not what Hooker is doing out there. So there's a lot more chance for Alan to take hard shots on the inside on the arms and then come back with something that Hooker is not prepared to defend.
Yeah, but there's a reason my initial read was this is a good style matchup for Hooker.
Yeah, and I'm gonna bank on that.
Mm-hmm.
Hooker is the underdog, opened at +134, dropped all the way down to -124, but is back up to +101. So those odds are trending close to dead even. Alan opened at -158, jumped all the way up to +102, and is back down at -123.
That's fine by me.
Yeah. Honestly, it should be a very close fight because Alan just does not, he doesn't finish people. And mm-hmm. Hooker, if you're going to let Hooker hang around, he's going to make that fight as hard as he possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're never going to beat Hooker by decision really easily.
No. No, and he might just knee Alan right in the face.
Yeah, and Hooker tends to be a better finisher. So.
Oh, yeah.
All right, that brings us to a lightweight bout. Paddy Pimblett, Kazula Vargas, and...
They're just reaching around. Who can Paddy Pimblett beat in the UFC? He doesn't... The matchmaker's having a panicked backroom meeting. Like, we got this British guy. All the fans love him. He doesn't seem that good, though. What do we do? And here they go. A matchup that he might not win.
Yeah. I mean...
I like Paddy Pimblett. A lot of people have turned to resenting him because he has, like, unwarranted fan response. I like him because he gets remarkably fat between fights.
Yeah, that it really is pretty remarkable.
Earned my respect.
Seeing pictures of him between fights, and he really...
unbelievably fat for a pro fighter. I love it.
Yeah.
He's going to be such a fat lord when he retires.
Real. I was going to say real Rampage Jackson vibes, but
no, he's even beyond. Like, yeah.
Jackson, even now when he's basically functionally retired, you can see footage of him in the gym, like working with his kid and stuff like that. And
yeah,
he's kind of keeping Rampage fit. You know, he definitely got out of shape by the end of his career, but and he always never really liked to stay in shape. But Pimblett seems like actively avoiding.
Within 2 years of retiring, Pimblett will age 20 years and pack on the kind of weight that when you see him at the pub where he will spend 18 hours a day, you'll be like, that guy wasn't a pro fighter. No. No way. I love him. But he's not an amazing fighter. He's super fun and scrappy and outrageous and charismatic.
Yep.
But he's a mess.
Yeah.
He's an absolute mess. And Kazula Vargas isn't.
No.
Kazula Vargas is actually quite a well put together fighter.
It's true.
He's a pretty crafty fighter. In fact, I really, really liked that performance he had against Rong Zhu.
Mm-hmm.
It was, jab centric, walking Zhu into counters. It was like a really smart, methodical sort of fight. It was the kind of MMA fight that, I don't know, it scratches a certain itch where I'm like, all right, this guy doesn't have like a ton of depth to his game. This is all kind of stuck together with chewing gum.
Yeah.
But all the pieces are definitely in the right place. The boat is floating, and I have to respect that.
What we've seen out of Rong Zhu over the short period he's been in the UFC is that he's a very slow-paced, very disconnected fighter. Mm-hmm. So I think what you really thought of Kazula Vargas in that fight is just like, when he gets to have things his own way, when he gets to set the tempo, he really can put together a good fight.
Yeah. Like just a real professional game plan being executed there. And then you do have other fights where he fights someone who's an absolute mess. So who could that be? Who's sort of Paddy Pimblett-esque on his record? Oh, Brock Weaver.
Pimblett is a much better athlete than Brock Weaver, yes. as shocking as that is to say.
That is absolutely true. He's a better athlete, and in many ways just a better fighter than Brock Weaver. Still a type of fighter who tends to just sort of smash into his opponent and make things happen by sheer recklessness. And Vargas just kind of destroyed Weaver.
Yeah, well, Weaver is a really minus athlete.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
But, you know, Vargas is like a reasonably good, accurate puncher.
Mm-hmm.
Could put nice combinations together. And just a very solid, stout offensive and defensive wrestler. So I see this at the very least as a close matchup in which Pimblett, if he wins, will do it with just like completely unpredictable craziness.
Yeah.
Which is certainly possible. It tends to be how he beats good fighters.
Yeah, he's got a ton of confidence and he fights with a ton of aggression. He's very Ronda Rousey. Really.
Mm-hmm.
Which is to say, like, if something goes wrong for Paddy Pimblett, his reaction is just to throw himself at it with that much more reckless abandon.
Yeah. Although, unlike Ronda Rousey, he's actually pretty comfortable being hit.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, Ronda Rousey both had a much deeper skill base than Paddy Pimblett and a much shallower one.
Yeah.
But the issue for them both is pretty similar. When, you know, when Ronda Rousey was uncomfortable being hit, all it made her do was try to like throw herself at that person with more intensity.
Yes, for sure.
So yeah, it is, there's definitely there will be an undressing for Pimblett at some point in the UFC.
Oh yeah, no doubt.
But it is, at least at the lower ends, it's hard to know exactly what that will be. To me, you know, it could be this fight. It could be.
It could be literally anything. That's the problem with his game. Yeah,
it could be literally anything because he nearly lost to Luigi Vendramini. He went out there and just threw himself onto a hook.
Yeah, I mean, the question is how unlike Nad Narimani is Rodrigo Vargas? He's got a lot of the same aspects to his game.
Yeah.
And Nad Narimani just kind of cleanly beat Paddy Pimblett.
It's true.
Because he's just like a good, well-rounded technical fighter.
So, it's also kind of how unlike Luigi Vendramini is Rodrigo Vargas.
Yeah. I mean, I like him, his game a lot better than Vendramini's, but
yeah,
it's not perfect.
It's not. You picking Vargas here?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. I can see the reason, honestly. Like, it is Pimblett. He's very much one of those. He's got a. I've made the Ronda Rousey comparison, but there's also just a bad case of Rashad Evans in there, or Shogun for that matter, where like that. There's a ton of movement to Pimblett's game when he's too far away to do anything.
He thinks he's being slick.
And then he just hops forward and sits right in front of his opponent with his chin online and just wings something.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the movement just disappears in that one moment.
Mm-hmm.
But it comes with a really ferocious aggression.
Mm-hmm. And he's super durable.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, he's a pretty solid athlete.
Yeah. He's not the world's best athlete, which is why there will be a reckoning to this. If he was an amazing athlete, he could get all the way up towards title contention just with that sort of raw aggression and
insane unchecked confidence.
Insanity. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he's not that kind of athlete. And the ceiling is much like more likely to be a lot firmer, but I'm not willing to say it's Cazula Vargas yet. I think Vargas really likes a slower-paced fight a lot, and that is what makes him comfortable. And I think that Pimblett can push a pace fast enough to show how shallow Vargas's game is and to show where he gets uncomfortable. Because if you get a little uncomfortable against Paddy Pimblett, he will leverage that. You know, he will just, as we saw with Vendramini, Vendramini was doing really well in their fight. And then Pimblett just kept increasing the pace more and more to the point that Vendramini wanted to take a break from it, wanted to step back and reset, and got no and couldn't. Pimblett was just right in his face, throwing more punches. And if Vargas can't go out and sleep Pimblett really fast, which is not actually something that he's really known to do.
No, I'm expecting this to turn into a grappling match when the craziness starts happening.
And that's where Pimblett's most technical. So I'm going to take Pimblett, but all these fights are going to be challenges for him every time. Odds are Pimblett is wildly favored. Opened at minus 225, currently down at minus 489. Vargas opened at plus 188, currently up at plus 364. All right. That brings us to a welterweight bout. Gunnar Nelson, Takashi Sato. And the only real question about this fight is how's Gunnar Nelson doing?
Yeah, I kind of forgot about Gunnar Nelson.
Yep. He has not fought for 3 years now.
Oh, boy.
Due to multiple rib injuries.
Ooh.
Yeah. Do you remember seeing that video floating around of Gunnar Nelson grappling with the mountain from Game of Thrones?
Yeah.
That was a really bad idea, it turns out.
Did he get his rib injured doing that?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yep. Absolutely got a rib separated. No. Having a 500-pound man fall on him.
Ugh.
Yep.
I mean, I'm not going to call the guy an idiot for doing it. Publicity stunt, whatever. Yeah. But man, that sucks.
Right. It's one of those things where you look at it and you're like, that's kind of cool, but also reckless. And then, you know, you hear him talk about it 2 years later and he's like, yeah, so had a really loud pop when we were doing that, and then realized I couldn't move very well afterward, and had a really bad injury, rib injury.
Man.
Yeah.
That feels particularly meaningless just for it to happen for such a silly reason.
Yeah. Because if we're not asking that question of how is Gunnar Nelson doing, this is an insanely winnable fight for Gunnar Nelson.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, Takashi Sato is, when I talk about problem, like a sort of stereotypical Japanese MMA fighter who does not thrive on the international circuit, Takashi Sato is the exact kind of fighter I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that it seems like every part of their game was developed in a little glass bottle, kept separately, and never to be mixed with any of the other parts.
And considering that, he's done remarkably well.
Yeah, he is a really good, accurate power puncher who will sit on and find his opportunities to counter.
A patient and accurate power puncher. Yeah. So he unnerves a lot of messier, more aggressive fighters by just being willing to let them walk into something. Not sure if letting Gunnar Nelson have time and space has ever been a particularly good way of beating him.
Yeah.
Especially Nelson, not when the way that you lose is when people take you down and submit you.
Yeah. Nelson loves to fight from way outside, keeps himself out of range to be hit. And then, you know, there is a moment where he runs face first into the clinch and can be cracked. But Santiago Ponzinibbio is the only person to ever really make that the path to victory. And there may have been a couple of eye pokes in there that got Gunnar Nelson well distracted from the shots that he was walking into.
Yeah. Hey, I'll say Rick Story famously did a pretty good job of countering Gunnar Nelson as well, but he also had a much more complete and interconnected game than Sato.
Yeah, and even then, he almost did not win that fight.
Well,
so he
did.
He did, but...
There's no way that fight should have been... No one should have been unclear about who won the majority of the rounds.
Yeah. But Gunnar Nelson, he's tricky because he has turned himself into a really pretty good clinch wrestler over the years with a nice variety of takedowns. Once he gets inside, he is absolutely determined on that front. He's still a great grappler, I'm sure. And he, like I said, he keeps himself far enough away from people most of the time otherwise that he's not going to be hit at any point other than the terms he's setting. And I just don't think Sato is going to take, he will have to time the perfect counterpunch. And I don't see that happening.
Yeah, I'm with you. Especially because he also tends to have very slow starts. Getting to the point where he has the timing on that shot. It's possible Gunnar could just launch in and grab him in a clinch and throw him down in the first couple minutes. Yeah, I'm going to take Gunnar as well. I have serious concerns and questions about his condition. Injuries aside, even if I didn't know about that, it would be a hell of a long layoff.
Yep.
But
still only 33, so he also may be at the kind of point where that actually just did him good.
Who knows? Yeah, since he was just kind of getting beaten up worse and worse before that.
Yeah, he'd been fighting for 12 years, so maybe just taking 3 years off is going to be good. And maybe, hey, if he spent less time during that whole time training at SBG Ireland, maybe his game improved too.
just sort of nascently got better by not being at SBG. So I'm going to pick him. It just seems like such a bad style matchup for Sato.
Yeah. Nelson is a wide favorite here. Opened at minus 300, got down to minus 442. At the moment, Takashi Sato opened at plus 250 and has risen steadily up to plus 334. There are questions to be asked, but most of them are not about the actual technique and style clash going on in the cage. That brings us to a woman's flyweight bout, Molly McCann, Luana Carolina. And, this is going to be incredibly messy. And I'm going to let you talk about it in a minute, but it is going to also be really kind of, I think it's going to be kind of, it's one of those things where I would love to see both fighters not fall into the trap that I expect them to fall into.
Oh.
Which is, I absolutely expect whoever leads this fight to be losing it. Every time they lead.
Interesting.
Because McCann and Carolina are two of the most remarkably counterable fighters in the UFC.
I was going to disagree with you there, because I was like, I don't see how Molly McCann wins this fight without coming forward. But then I realized it's by letting Carolina come forward. I totally see what you're saying now.
Because I think of Molly McCann's fight with I think it was Laura Procopio, or maybe it was Diana Belbita. I don't know. They're all very similar. No, that's right. It was Ariana Lipsky. That was the fight. And it was literally whoever was on the front foot was losing constantly. Whoever decided to grit their teeth and sit down on something would immediately get countered really hard.
It's a very funny dynamic.
It is, and it's consistently one that Molly McCann sets. And it's pretty much, the thing with Carolina is that she, much like the most ridiculous sort of dim shade of Arnold Allen will always give up the front foot and try to counter off her back foot. And she actually has some sharp counters, but she's also just insanely hittable. Mm-hmm. So anytime she throws first, she gets hit really hard.
Yeah, she has the worst defensive reactions in the world, even compared to all the other fighters who really just expect that being tall is going to save them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so then I guess the other question becomes, if McCann, it sort of comes back to, doesn't McCann have to come forward? Because
Carolina won't. Most likely.
Yeah, right. If she hangs back, how does she make Carolina engage? And if Carolina doesn't, what can Molly McCann possibly do? I also just don't really think it's in McCann's nature to refuse that kind of invitation.
No, it's not. I mean, McCann is going to be the one on the front foot no matter what.
Yeah.
So the question then becomes, does she walk into punches all the whole way through? Or does she get Carolina throwing and then counter on the front foot? And most likely she walks into punches all the way through. And I'm not even sure she loses that fight. But
no, it's still going to be a mess.
It's still going to be an absolute mess.
But it's just such a barrier of range for McCann to get her own shots home.
Yeah.
That and she's so hittable herself. Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm going to pick Carolina. It would be really funny if it turned into a staring match where McCann, against all odds, knows what you're talking about and is like, I'm going to make her come forward, but doesn't know how to do that. Because, well, I'm not even sure how she would. If Carolina didn't want to come forward, how do you make her? I guess kick her leg to pieces or something, you know, something that puts some pressure on her to close the gap. But it's not really McCann's thing.
Yeah. It's going to be a ridiculous fight, honestly.
Yeah. So glad it's on the main card over something like Shore Valley.
Just for the hell of it, I'm going to pick McCann. Just because I think that, like, she can fall into the clinch more and just, like, slog this fight along the cage.
Sure.
And that's not, like...
That sounds great.
Yeah.
That's an aspirational pick right there.
It really is.
I really hope we see that.
But honestly, like I really have the feeling McCann is going to fight the exact wrong fight. And she might win it anyway, because Carolina has a very narrow margin of victory herself.
Yeah.
But McCann will make this fight harder on herself than she needs to. Almost without fail.
Carolina has still been a lot better than I thought she was going to.
Yeah, she is actually developing. She is she's getting calmer in the cage. Mm-hmm. And for somebody who is going to be on the back foot, letting their opponent punch them first and then trying to counter, just getting calmer and more collected about it is going to be a big help.
She's sort of the Kennedy and Zechiku of this division.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, I would not have guessed that guy would be anything even close to competent when I first saw him in the UFC.
Yeah.
But he's kind of made it work.
Yep. Can't open at -150, jumped up to +105, and was hanging pretty solid around there for the past, for a few days before the past week, where she's fallen steadily down to -137. Odds should not be getting longer on Molly. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Carolina opened at +130, dropped to -120, and is currently up at +112. Yeah. Just.
I'd say flip a coin for each round.
Yeah.
You know, like, who knows?
It really. If McCann gets a takedown in there, she can easily steal a whole round. If she holds Carolina on the fence and just gets kneed a bunch of times, she could lose a round.
Mm-hmm. Or win that round, depending on how the judges are feeling.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Very much I expect her to be throwing first, landing, and getting hit on the counter. And it might be that she's getting hit on the counter harder than she's even landing. So, because Molly, when she's on the front foot, she profoundly overreaches her feet and hangs her chin out there. Like, it's really, I think it's part of why I say this all is it's down to the night and day difference for McCann in her fights, where she is just in a much better boxer off her back foot. She reminds me a lot of Ross Pearson. That is
the comparison. Absolutely. That's the first fight I thought of when you said, when you talked about that dynamic is the first fighter I thought of, because it's happened numerous times.
Yeah. Where like on the front foot, Ross Pearson is a miserable boxer, but on the back foot, he was great and he just didn't ever seem to know it.
Yeah. Yeah. That Paul Felder fight, I will never forget that. It was just like, oh my God, you're so close to winning this fight and you just won't let yourself do it.
Yeah, all you have to do is let Paul Felder come to you.
And he wants to. That's one where it really was on the table. Paul Felder wants to slowly march forward.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. That brings us to a lightweight bout. Jai Herbert, Ilia Topuria. I'm fascinated by this lightweight move for Topuria.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's 5'7". Like, I get that he's kind of also seems like he's 5'7" across too. He's got a real Mirsad Bektic build to him.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say like Tsarukyan. He's got that got a very broad frame.
He's got a very broad frame. So I get that, you know, there's room for him to Mike Chandler it up potentially.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's not, I'm still surprised. I'm surprised that he ended up having to make that change.
Mm-hmm.
Or feeling the need to make that change, because it seemed like he was on his way to being a very physically successful featherweight.
Mm-hmm.
And Jai Herbert is 6'1". So that will make this, he's got an 8-inch reach advantage.
Oh boy.
Two. Yeah.
Herbert, it was that big.
Topuria's got a 69-inch reach, Herbert 77.
Good lord.
So that is the thing with Herbert, is that almost all of his game is unstructured and messy,
mm-hmm.
except that he's really long and he fights long.
Mm-hmm.
He can snap out really good 1-2s. And he's fast, so that catches people off guard. The moment fights start, he is fast and snapping out 1-2s. I'm like, holy crap, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
But if you can fight past that, then there are a lot of holes in his game. He's a lot in that way, kind of like Andre Ewell.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're like, oh, wow, this guy, he's a really good range boxer. And then you see every other part of his game, and you're like, okay, but not a good close-in boxer, not a good wrestler.
And maybe not as good a range boxer as I thought, because he can't stop you from doing the other things.
Yeah. Topuria, he's really durable. He's very functional about knowing how to close the distance and getting inside and working the body and moving, changing targets.
Mm-hmm.
And I expect, you know, maybe he'll have a moment early in this fight where he's just like, damn it, this guy's huge and really rangy and that's a huge pain in my ass. But if he can get past that, I expect him to take over the fight.
Yeah, I do expect not only for the reach, but just the weight class change. Like, it's often a thing where you just have to, like, get used to what it feels like to box in this or to fight in this like new body that you've mm-hmm. put yourself into. But like what happens if Jai Herbert has success and it doesn't finish Topuria is that Topuria does what he does,
mm-hmm.
which is like, oh, I have to get in this dude's face. I have to punch him in the body. I have to shoot takedowns. I have to pressure hard.
Yep.
And I don't think, Herbert deals with that well. Again, the long boxing, as with Andre Ewell, is a bit of a facade. If you just sort of don't respect the 1-2s the way he wants you to, there's not a whole lot of subtlety or depth to back that up.
Yeah, and he gets really a little spastic when he hits the mat, which means that he he makes big mistakes that put him in position to get submitted, to give up good positions.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, seems like a pretty easy pick for Topuria here.
Yep, agreed.
Topuria is a big favorite, opened at minus 500, jumped up to minus 395, and is currently back down at minus 491. Herbert opened at plus 375, dropped down to plus 305, and is currently up at plus 361. All right, that wraps us up for the main card. You can find me on Twitter at TheZaneSimon. You can find Connor on Twitter at BoxingBush. You can find both of us over at BloodyElbow.com. Give us a like, subscribe to our podcasts on Bloody Elbow Presents on SoundCloud, YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, all that good stuff. And as always, the MMA Viv section is brought to you by Chris Reaney and his book, The Fine Art of Violence, which you can find over at his website, ChrisReaney.com, ChrisReaney.com.
Thank you for listening to this Bloody Elbow Presents production. To check out more of our content, hop over to the Bloody Elbow Presents SoundCloud and iTunes pages, as well as subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is titled Bloody Elbow Presents. We're also on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, Overcast, Player FM, and Amazon Music. Just search for Bloody Elbow Presents and you'll get brand new shows throughout the week, including Care Don't Care, The Mookie and Crookie Show, The Open Guard Cast, The MMA Vivisection, The Level Change Podcast, The Sixth Round Post Fight Show, Sixth Round Retro, The MMA Depressed Us, Crooklyn's Corner, and Radio Style Play-by-Play for every UFC pay-per-view. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Bloody Elbow, Facebook at facebook.com/bloodyelbowblog, and of course on bloodyelbow.com.